And good evening. I'm Jackie Yamanaka in the studio with Jim Gransberry, agricultural and political reporter with the Billings Gazette. We are back for another one of our call-in programs featuring either one of our state officials or candidates. We're going to be starting soon our introductions to the candidates running for statewide office in Montana. But tonight, we are pleased to welcome Governor Brian Schweitzer, who is back from a nearly two-week-long barnstorming trip to the East Coast. Governor, good evening and welcome.
Well, it's great to be here. And, of course, it was interrupted. I was in Washington, D.C. for the National Governors Association. I spoke at the University of Virginia. I spoke at Columbia University in New York City. I met with a large number of potential investors in alternative energies in Montana. I met with General Electric. I met with the Southern Company. I met with folks from Shell Oil Company. I met with other folks that have an active interest in developing energy in Montana. And while I didn't bring any signed contracts back, these things take a little bit of time. And if you don't stand by the stream and cast a number of times, you just will not catch fish. And so I'm going to keep fishing.
You may want to check on your fly. We are also going to be taking
good, Jackie.
Make sure you have a fly on there.
Now, this time of year, you better be using a nymph.
I know. We will be taking your calls. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question for Governor Brian Schweitzer, in Billings, 657-2941. If you're outside of the Billings call area, 1-800-441-2941. Jim.
Well, this trip to the eastern provinces, what maybe single entity or thing do you think that you accomplished by doing this? You didn't get the signed contract, but there and... But there's got to be some concrete results.
Well, there's a couple of things that I think that are probably more promising than anything. One of them is as we develop coal gasification in Montana and in the West, we have the opportunity of removing the carbon dioxide. But you see, we really don't have a protocol for what is sequestration. How deep do you need to pump that carbon dioxide? What formation does it need to be in? How will we monitor that carbon dioxide that as it remains in storage? So I met with the folks at Columbia University, and they have an active interest in helping us develop this protocol. And I've presented this with the Western Governors Association, and at our May meeting in Arizona, we're going to take this issue up, and we're going to begin putting protocol together, because as there are more and more people who are using carbon dioxide for enhanced oil recovery, and as more coal gasification gets developed in this country, in particular in the Western United States, we need to have a protocol on how we handle carbon dioxide so that we do it right.
I want to ask you, because when you're talking to potential investors and also trying to lure such a facility to Montana, one of the states you have to compete with is Wyoming. And Wyoming is the nation's largest supplier of coal. It also has the largest infrastructure for dealing with coal. You've got it's a right-to-work state. You've got no individual and corporate income tax and so forth. So how do you sell Montana then when we're competing with the neighbor? And the companies could say, you know, we could locate a plant right near the border. We could take advantages of all of the Wyoming structure, and we could still take some Montana coal.
This is not a competition. There is enough demand for clean coal technology, whether that's producing electrons to ship to the California market, who are saying they need an additional 20,000 megawatts of electricity, or whether we're shipping to Oregon and Washington, where we already have corridors. We've already been shipping electrons to Washington and Oregon for the last 25 years. Or if it's gasification that becomes liquefaction. We use 23 million barrels of oil per day in this country. About 60% of it is imported. So 13, 14 million barrels, and we're producing almost none of it with coal today. So you see, there is room for Wyoming to have a half dozen, West Virginia half dozen, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, Montana. We are not competing against other states. This technology is coming, and it will be placed in many locations across the country. They are building a plant right now in Pennsylvania, a 5,000-barrel liquefaction plant. They're building a, Rentec tells me from Denver, Colorado, that they're building a 2,000-barrel plant in Illinois, and they're building an 11,000-barrel plant in Mississippi. So this technology is coming, and Montana is sitting on the best quality, the greatest quantity of coal. It is true that Wyoming mines more coal than all the other states put together. It is true that they mine about nine times as much coal as we do. But almost all of their coal is coal by rail. And the reason they have been successful is they've managed to get Union Pacific to build their rail right by all of those big coal mines. And we're in a situation where we have a spur that goes down to Sarpy, a spur that goes down to Colstrip. And we would need a spur that goes up to, for example, West Circle or to Otter Creek. Or we don't even have a spur that goes to Roundup. And we've had a coal mine there for some time. So it's going to take some infrastructure in Montana. But I don't believe the price of oil is going to drop below $30 a barrel for any significant period of time. That means that coal and clean coal technology is something that we'll be looking at for the future. But I'm not just focused on clean coal technology. Biodiesel, ethanol. I met with some investors that are looking at ethanol, and they're looking at ethanol beyond corn and beyond barley, looking at other crops. You've heard the crop switchgrass. Switchgrass will actually produce up to 1,100 gallons of ethanol per acre. It's a native grass. It's one that actually we could grow on CRP in Montana. It's one that, under the proper conditions, will produce up to 11 ton.
But it's not really being grown here, I inquired.
No, it's not being grown here. It is being grown in, for example, South Dakota and Nebraska. Switchgrass is one of the species they use in CRP. I'm telling you, I know because I farmed out in Forsyth. You could put switchgrass under a center pivot in Forsyth, and you could make that 8 to 10 ton per acre of switchgrass.
Because the inputs are so low.
And the advantage of this is it's a perennial. You're not replanting it every year, and it doesn't respond so positively to nitrogen like a lot of the improved crops. Now, the downside with switchgrass is that it is not carbohydrate ready. You have to use a steam physical process to break the cell walls, and then it releases the carbohydrate. The upside is that it is a 5-to-1 positive energy balance. Some people say that the downside with ethanol, with corn or barley or low-protein wheat is, you know, it's about 65 to 80 units in for 100 units out. But this is a 5-to-1 payback. And what's the equipment that you need on the farm? A swather, a round baler. And then you need to have a facility not too far away because you can't haul that kind of tonnage too far. So there are some real opportunities. Biodiesel. That's one I'm very excited about. And Montana has a real advantage because we can grow safflower, canola, camelina, and we can even grow soybeans. And many of you know that while I farmed in Forsyth, I was making nearly 60 bushel yields of soybeans under center pivots along the Yellowstone River. So soybeans, camelina, canola, safflower, all great oilseed crops, all produce biodiesel.
In our studio this evening, Governor Brian Schweitzer. All of our lines are full at the moment, Brian, so let's go ahead and go to our first caller who's waiting patiently in Bozeman.
Hi, Governor Schweitzer. Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate the challenges that are involved in dealing with this issue, so I'll say that in advance, but I'm really concerned about the state of the Yellowstone bison, and I'm wondering if you could give us an update on what your thoughts are about managing that problem.
Well, to start with, I think it's an opportunity, not a problem. Let's go back in history just a little bit. The bison herd that we have in Yellowstone Park was introduced from three separate bison herds around the turn of the century or later, and it is now grown from just 30 or 40 to as many as 4,500. And during the winter, the bison are going to move out to find some winter range. When the snow gets deep, they're going to move, and they move down the drainages. And unfortunately, that means that they end up in the Gardner area, and they end up in West Yellowstone. The problem that we have is that in those areas, we have some, not many, but some small cattle herds. Now, APHIS, which is the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service of the USDA, and the 50 states' veterinarians, they decide which states will retain a brucellosis-free status. Now, Wyoming and Idaho have already lost their brucellosis-free status, and it wasn't even because of bison, it was elk. The elk population in Wyoming has about 35% to 40% endemic with brucellosis, and they have demonstrated that brucellosis will cross species from elk to cattle. Now, here's our dilemma in Montana. That small number of cattle that are in the West Yellowstone area and in the Gardner area, that bison move out of the park, and there's no fence there, and there will not be a fence. We can't stop the bison from moving out when the snow is deep. They come out, and for the last numbers of years, the management technique has been to haze them back into the park or round them up and slaughter them. Now, it makes sense to me that we have to have a situation where cattle and bison are not co-located in the same area. If we do not have bison co-located with cattle, we have a zero chance of brucellosis transmission. And the APHIS, that's USDA, and the state's veterinarians from all 50 of those states, they will recognize that. And they will recognize that Montana has made positive steps and that we will not be one of those states that they are watching for a brucellosis outbreak. Now, what are the steps that we would need to take? Well, there are a small number of cattle operators in that area. We would like to raise private and public money. By public money, I'm saying USDA has been spending $750,000 a year to pay the Department of Livestock to haze those bison back into the park. Why don't we find a way of buying easements on those small pieces of property in those contained basins and remove the cattle? Now, we would pay these operators a large sum of money. They can continue to raise horses or mules there, but just remove cattle and sheep. Remove the possibility of any transmission. Then, we allow the bison to range a little bit further out of the park, but we create a zone that they can be within. If they, for example, if you understand the geography in the park, if they get to Hebgen Lake or the dam up there, that's it. That's as far as they can go. We will not allow bison to go beyond that, and it would be literally a drop-dead zone. The same is true, for example, if they were to move up towards the Gallatin River. There would be a drop-dead zone there as well. And over in the Gardner area, maybe Yankee Jim Canyon or something like that. The bison are not likely to go over the top of the mountain. But, you know, in northern Alberta, they have the Woods Bison Herd. It's about 4,500 head of bison. About 40% of them have brucellosis. And they manage them by letting them wander over a larger area. But there is a place at which if anybody in Alberta sees one of those bison, they can shoot them on sight 12 months of the year. Now, let's further add to the control of the size of the bison herd. As it increases in numbers, it will continually leave the park. And that's why I think that we can manage those numbers with a hunt. And that hunt would be contained within those geographical areas that we've just described. Now, this is a little complicated. It's going to take us a few years to get there, but it is a permanent solution. We cannot allow our cattle industry to lose our brucellosis-free status, but we also have to recognize that the bison are wild animals, that we can manage them with a hunt, and we need to remove the possibility of transmission of brucellosis. The management system that we have right now is setting us up for a potential wreck. Wyoming and Idaho played by the rules over the course of the last 5 years, and they have lost their brucellosis-free status. I will not stand for Montana standing still and allowing APHIS to remove our brucellosis-free status. That's why we want to make some positive steps.
Before we go to our next caller, I also want to add that there's also discussion of creating a disease-free herd through the quarantine system of finding those disease-free bison.
Well, you know, and we've talked about that in the past as well. But what you would need to do, here's specifically to eradicate brucellosis in the basin, you'd have to eradicate the brucellosis in the elk herd in Wyoming. Okay? That's a little complicated. Now, in order to eradicate the brucellosis in elk and bison, you would have to round up them all, both in Wyoming and Idaho, and in Montana for that matter, and all the bison in the park. Well, that is significant challenges. One more thing. When you find a young animal that is brucellosis-free, a young heifer, for example, you will not know that she's brucellosis-free until she has had her first calf. Sometimes the titer doesn't increase until she has her first calf. So if you find a young bison, young female, she's brucellosis-free, well, you can't just load her up and take her someplace else and store her away from the park. You've got to put her in quarantine until she's had her first calf. This takes a significant period of time. Of course, I would like to eliminate brucellosis from the Yellowstone Basin, but this is very complicated, and I got to tell you, right now, the memorandum of understanding that we have between the agencies has nothing built into it to eliminate brucellosis. Only the words, none of the action.
Right. Let's go now to a caller in Forsyth.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Mr. Governor Schweitzer.
Yes, it is.
This is Arden Post.
How are you?
Good. I'm concerned about what the average person can do to help the energy situation here in Montana, and whether promotion or conservation is going to make any difference on our part.
Arlen, here's the deal. The world supply of oil is running flat out. During the last 20 years, the Saudis always had the possibility of increasing by 20, 30, 40%. If there was ever a situation that we needed more oil, they just opened their spigots and supplied more oil. In fact, when the price of oil got too high and other people started taking their market share, they just opened the valves and dumped oil on the market, and then there was more oil than we could consume. But with the Chinese and Indian markets increasing so fast, so rapidly increasing their demand, in fact, China is the number two importer of oil behind the United States. Every single oil production field in the world is running flat out, and we can't keep up with demand. The only way that we can create an opportunity for some respite during the next 10 years is through energy efficiencies. Now, let me tell you what you can do personally. Nancy and I have bought a diesel Jetta car, and we're running it on biodiesel. It gets 50 miles per gallon. It's a very comfortable little car. It's a Volkswagen, but gosh, you know, the American manufacturers aren't making a vehicle like that. And we can run it on Montana canola. It smells nice. It smells like you're cooking something. And it's something that we can produce annually in Montana. We had something that we call Warm Hearts for Warm Homes, and that's where we had volunteers from the state of Montana that helped people winterize their homes, help them change the filters in their boilers or in their heating system at home, put caulking in around windows and doors, change the light bulbs to those fluorescent, those curly-cue fluorescents. We can save up to 20% right now and not decrease our quality of life. We cannot produce 20% more energy. We can't build that much wind power capacity. We can't build clean coal technology. We can't increase ethanol and biodiesel to a great extent during the next 5 to 10 years. It takes time to build these energy propositions. In the meantime, we can extend energy efficiencies. Every single person can do their part, and every single person should do their part.
Let's go now to, Jim.
I'd like to suggest that whenever possible that people take in, you have attics that have got little or no insulation in them, the return for, say, blowing in insulation can be amortized rather quickly, especially with the price of natural gas being what it is. And that's another one of the simple ways to conserve heat and get your money back rather
By the
rapidly.
Way... you can just turn that expenditure in on your taxes, and you'll save $500 on your Montana income taxes. That's a tax credit that we will give you. If you spend some money winterizing, making your home or your business more efficient, send us the bill. State of Montana will help you pay for it.
Let's go to a caller in Cut Bank.
Hello.
Hello. You have a question for Governor Schweitzer.
Yes, Governor, I'm wondering, what is your weighty decision on the design of the new Montana Quarter?
Well, look, here's where we're at right now. There are four quarter designs, and we're taking input. We're having people vote on them. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. Let me tell you what I'm faced with right now. My mother... who is 80 years old, and she may even be listening. I hope not. She has told me that she doesn't care which one I pick as long as it's not one of them. She has one that she hates. My wife has a favorite, and my children all have a favorite. I have three children, and they have three different favorites. And so people from all over Montana are going to the Montana website, Discover Montana, and they are voting, and we're taking the input from the people of Montana. It is very difficult to take one snapshot of Montana and represent all of the energy, the fiber, the social and cultural system, the mountains, the prairies, the rivers, the species in one snapshot. I wish we could have 50 quarters because Montana is that big and magnificent. We're only going to have one. I am waiting for the input from the people of Montana, so go to Discover Montana and cast your vote.
Let's go now to a caller in Bozeman.
Good evening. I'm curious if, with the next legislative session next winter, if a minimum wage bill was passed, say, I don't know, something along the lines of an increase to up to $7 or $8 an hour over a period of a year or two, would you sign it?
Well, actually, I don't think I'll even have to, because I'm going to support the referendum. There will be a referendum on the ballot in November that will give us an opportunity to increase the minimum wage, and I, for one, will vote for it. I think it'll pass. I think that probably 60-70% of Montana supports it.
I'd like to make a comment on the minimum wage. Recently, there was a study done about corporate executive salaries and benefits going up. And in the period from 1990 to 2005, had the minimum wage kept pace with the percentage increase in corporate pay for CEOs, the minimum wage would be $23.02.
Let's go now to a caller in Livingston.
Hi, Governor. How you doing?
Well, we're doing great. Thanks for calling in.
I have a question. You said the technologies are there for coal bed methane production. One thing you didn't say mention was, what are you going to do with the waste? How are you going to? The technologies are there to get to handle the waste. I know they are. I read about them. But are these people going to come in to deal with the waste, or just leave it there?
Well, thank you very much. There's actually a couple of issues here. We were talking about coal gasification, which is actually dry coal and then putting it under high pressure and temperature, and it will release a methane gas at that point. Coal bed methane is a different animal, and we'll describe what that one is. Oftentimes, coal is not near the surface. Sometimes it's 100 or 400 or 800 feet or even 1,500 feet deep. And across the prairie of Montana, when the bed of coal, maybe it's 50 feet thick, 40 feet thick, 100 feet thick, when it's deep in the earth, it becomes an aquifer, because the coal is like a sponge, and the water will find a way of storing itself there. Under the circumstances where there is shale above and below the coal, so that the water gets trapped and it's under pressure, then through the eons of time, the coal begins to degrade and it creates a methane gas. The methane gas cannot escape, so it is stored under pressure with the water and the coal. Now, coal bed methane production is producers who drill a well to that bed of coal, and then they pump the water out, which releases the pressure, and then the gas starts to flow. The problem is that in many cases, the water is high, not particularly high in salt. You hear people talk about salt. It isn't that it's high in salt. You can drink this water. It doesn't taste that good, but cattle and people all over eastern Montana, Jackie's nodding. She grew up on that stuff, and you can make coffee out of it. You can mix it with whiskey,
Kool-Aid.
But it's terrible to drink it straight. It's sodic water. And what that means is that it has a high sodium absorption ratio. The sodium absorption ratio is the relative proportion of sodium to two other minerals, calcium and magnesium. And when you have water that is high in sodium absorption ratio, this water is very bad to put on the surface of the soil. If you use it as irrigation water, it will tend to turn the soil into cement. So there's a couple of solutions, at least a couple of solutions. I'll give you three solutions. Number one, if you are going to develop this coal bed methane, when you pump the water out, then what you should do is you should treat the water, remove the sodium, and then you could put that water into an irrigation system, or actually put it in a river or canal so that some farmer downstream could use it. That's number one. The second thing that you could do is you could pump the water out of one zone, because in many cases, there will be a coal bed at 100 feet, another one at 400 feet, another one at 800 feet, another one at 900 feet. So what you could actually do is you could remove the water from the surface zone and produce the gas, and then that surface zone would be dry. Then as you develop the other zones, you could pump it back into the surface zone so that you wouldn't be releasing this sodic water, A, and B, when you were all done, the rancher would still have water to water their livestock. The third thing that you could do is you could build one of these coal gasification plants in an area where the coal is very close to the surface in one spot, but you have coal bed methane around. And then you could pump that sodic water to the coal gasification plant, use the water in the gasification process, and in the process remove the sodium so that you wouldn't release any water into the irrigated land. There are many things that we can do to produce energy, but I don't believe that we ought to steal from Peter to pay Paul. I don't believe that the ranchers who have been on this land for 100 years ought to give up their rights to quality soil for irrigation, or that they ought to lose the water for their livestock so that we can produce energy. I think that we can do both, and we can do it in a way that all Montana will be proud.
In case you've just joined us in our studio this evening, Governor Brian Schweitzer, I'm Jackie Yamanaka, also with Jim Gransbury, agricultural and political reporter of the Billings Gazette. We are taking calls. I notice all of our lines, Governor, are busy, and they've stayed busy throughout the program.
Well, as you know, Jackie, when I get a question like coal bed methane, I like to explain it in a very detailed way, because so much of Montana understands portions of it, but I want them to understand exactly what it is that we're dealing with. I am a soil scientist. I understand the chemistry and biology here, and I'm also a guy that is interested in energy. So I think it's important for all of Montana to understand what we're dealing with.
And luckily here on public radio, we can give you a little bit of that time anyway. Let's go now to a caller from Big Timber.
Hi, Governor.
Hi there.
I understand that the legislature met in a special session to authorize emergency funding for the Montana Public Employee Retirement Fund a few months ago. And what would you suggest that I do with my money? Should I risk leaving it in this account and losing everything because there are less people working, or when at least when I retire? Or should I invest myself in a mutual fund and forgo the matching fund of my employer?
We have a constitutional requirement to make people whole that are in our pension fund. That money is absolutely safe, and it is guaranteed by the state of Montana. We did put $100 million in. You know, previous legislatures in the 99 and 2001 session, they decided that since we had made such good returns during the 90s in the stock market, that they could afford to give more out as benefits immediately with the expectation that they would be able to make up the difference by high stock market returns. Well, the stock market only sometimes increases in value at 11 to 15%. And when it went back to its normal of 8 or 7%, and actually went a couple of years where it decreased in value, it put all of the pension at risk. It was not good money management in 1991 and 2001. These folks did not understand conservative management of money, and it did put us in a bind. That's why we stepped up and we put $100 million into that pension fund to begin to make those pensioners whole. Now, for those of you who don't have a public pension, you may be saying, hey, what about me? I lost money in the stock market. Nobody gave me money. But here's the deal. You don't have the constitutional right. This is a right and an obligation of the people to those people who have worked for the state of Montana to make sure that their pension is made whole. I am absolutely sure that your pension is safe, and the state of Montana has broad enough shoulders to make it right, and we'll be there when you retire.
How much more is going to be needed to infuse?
Well, it depends. This last year, Terry Moore, who is the head of our Board of Investments, told me that we made an 8.33% return. As we make those kinds of returns over a course of 30 years, we'll make up that differential. We're only making projections because we're saying if you put in X amount of money today and it grows at Y percent over the next 30 years, you'll get to a certain place. Those are all projections, but I can tell you this, by putting $100 million in and allowing it to grow at 8.3% over the course of the next 30 years, we're well on our way to making that pension whole.
Okay. Let's go now to a caller in Gardner.
Hi, Governor.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. I wanted to get back to the Yellowstone bison. I appreciate some of what you said earlier about changes in the management decision, and specifically removing cattle from the critical winter range of the buffalo. And I do think that we can work to to protect migration corridors and allow bison to utilize public lands within Montana. I think that's something that should be a goal. And also just wanted to point out that the Yellowstone herd is extremely unique because they are the only continuously wild herd. They weren't entirely introduced. There were 23 survivors from the 19th century slaughter that took refuge in Yellowstone's Pelican Valley. And those are the descendants, the buffalo that we see today. And a couple of questions for you. The first is, how do you plan to involve Native American tribes in management decisions affecting the buffalo? And secondly, do you still feel that the DOL is ill-equipped to manage our wild buffalo?
Well, a couple of things, and let's just hold on for a little bit there, cowgirl. Until we have a bison herd that is brucellosis-free, I am not advocating that bison run wild across the public lands of Montana. I'm talking about maintaining them in just that small geographical area as they seek winter range in the Gardner area and in the West Yellowstone area. As to management of the bison and involving our Indian reservations, what I've suggested is some of these young females that we have in quarantine, as we raise them until they've had their first calf, and we now know that they are pure bison because they came from the park, as you've described, and they are brucellosis-free, I would like to see them go out to some Indian nations where they would agree to manage them isolated from other bison so that the DNA remains pure and that they agree to keep them brucellosis and tuberculosis-free, and that they grow those herds outside of the Yellowstone Basin. And if such a time in the future some technology comes along that we can eradicate brucellosis in the park, we will have a repository of genetics scattered around Montana that will protect that wild population to repopulate the park. Those are just some of the ideas. And one more thing. What we're talking about is private landowners with private land rights. What we're talking about is paying them, compensating them to agree to an easement not to raise cattle. This is not the big hand of government coming in and telling people what they cannot do on their private land. It is a government that is working with just a few cattle producers so that we don't jeopardize the other 2.5 million head of cattle in Montana. There is a solution, and it takes one of cattlemen and sportsmen. It takes people living in the greater Gardner and Yellowstone region to work together with people across Montana. No one is going to get 100% of their way. It is a very contentious issue. I know because I visit with conservation groups, hunting groups, cattlemen groups, and a lot of people have preconceived notions, and I need people to take a deep breath, settle down, and let's start talking about a real new management system that works for Montana.
Let's go now to a caller who's waiting on the line from Billings.
Hi there.
Yes, your question for the governor.
Yes, as I was listening to the last, in terms of brucellosis controversy, has there actually ever been a case of brucellosis transferring from a buffalo to domestic cattle that we know of?
We do not know of one. No one has been able to describe it for us, but we know that it is possible. We know that it's cross-species, obviously, from cattle to buffalo. We know that it is cross-species from buffalo to elk, and now we know it is cross-species from elk back to cattle. Let me explain how it would cross-species. Brucellosis is a disease that causes abortions, and what will happen is, for example, a cow, or in this case a bison, gets to her maybe fourth month and fifth month, something like that, and she aborts a fetus, and that fetus is laying on the ground someplace, and maybe 5 days or 8 days later, a cow comes along, and buffalo, elk, they look at things with their eyes, but they also smell it. So that cow puts her head down, and she takes a big sniff. And that's the way she ingests the disease. And while I don't know of the people who have said, yeah, we've seen this happen in the wild, it is clearly possible. And frankly, that it has not happened. Montana is not in a position to make these decisions. Remember I mentioned at the beginning, the United States Department of Agriculture, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, and the other 50 state veterinarians. If they decide that Montana has brucellosis, then we lose our brucellosis-free status. So whatever standard we choose, we have to not only please science, but please these agencies and these veterinarians from around America. So we will continue to work with them, but we're going to use sound science. And whenever people start getting into philosophy and theology and away from science, then I'm going to step them right back, because I am a scientist. I'm an agricultural scientist. I understand this disease, and I'm going to make doggone sure that we protect our brucellosis-free status, but I think we've got to manage the bison herd in a different way.
Jim.
I might mention that while there has never been a documented case of transmission of brucellosis in the wild from bison to cattle, a controlled experiment at the Texas A&M proved that transmission of brucellosis from bison to cattle is possible.
And we also should mention, Governor, that there is a human element, and that infected domestic animals, anyway, certainly can transmit to humans, and it's also a concern with sportsmen if they are potentially field dressing sick animals.
The human disease is called undulant fever, and there are people that have worked around livestock that have brucellosis that are contracting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in addition to creating these abortions, which would be terrible in the cattle industry, in addition to Montana losing its brucellosis-free status, which would cost us really hundreds of millions of dollars with additional testing and losing potential market share with our purebred cattle industry, there's also the human risk for veterinarians and those of us who work around cattle.
Right, and it's like having the flu that just never goes away. Let's go now to a caller who's waiting patiently from Lewistown.
Good evening, Governor.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Say, my question is this. You speak very eloquently about your vision for alternative energy development in Montana. And so my question is, does woody biomass or forest residue have a place in that vision? And if so, what is that place?
Absolutely. There's two ways that we can use woody biomass. There's three ways. Number one, and we're already using it in Montana, is something called fuels to schools. And that is where that biomass just goes right in boilers, and it produces the heat to heat schools. And we're using that in some places across Montana. The second way is this Fischer-Tropsch process that we've talked about of converting coal to liquid diesel or aviation fuel. You could actually use wood biomass to do the same. And then the third one, and this is very interesting, this switchgrass that we were talking about, this is making ethanol in a cellulosic system, where you have to, if you have a very fibrous plant or something like wood chips, what you have to do is you have to crush the cell wall, which will release the carbohydrate. You can actually make ethanol out of wood chips in the same way. So I think that we have a lot of opportunity, and I'm excited about it because there is so much of Montana that we've harvested timber on maybe 40 or 50 or 60 years ago, and now we get kind of overgrown with small diameter wood, and we need to go in and thin that wood because it really becomes a fire hazard. But what would you do with it if you did thin it? Because it's too small a diameter to have much value as 2x4s or 2x8s or something like that. But if we had mills close by that could actually produce energy sources, there's something we could do with it. It would create thousands of jobs in Montana. It would help decrease our dependency on foreign oil. Very good question. Thank you.
Let's go now to a caller in Billings. Hello?
Oh, this is Livingston.
Oh, okay.
Well, we love Livingston, too.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, we'll give it a try here. Nice to talk to you, Governor, again.
You betcha.
Met you one time. Very impressed. Quick two-part question. One, the PSC seems to be trying to get on track to re-regulate the energy company in this state, and I would like to know what your administration plans to do proactively in that area to fix the mistake that we had. And two, I have seen ads, even from other countries, advertising basically the health of their workforce and using that as an opportunity to bring business into this state. And or into their areas, and I want to know basically what your administration would do to help try to improve that and prove to people that this can be an opportunity instead of a burden. It seems like everyone seems to look at this as some sort of burden. And thank you for your time tonight, and I'll listen to your answer.
Well, thank you very much. We'll talk about re-regulation and deregulation. When we deregulated, that allowed Montana Power to separate the ownership of generation, transmission, and distribution. Today, the only entity that we still have some regulation over is the one that has the transmission and distribution. Northwestern Energy at this time has a very small amount of generation in their portfolio. And so in order for them to be more efficient as a regulated entity, they would have to build new generation. Here's the rub. The old generation that we had, the dams along the Missouri River, for example, are the cheapest source of electricity in America, and the old coal technology at Colstrip in particular, in the one in Billings, that's some of the cheapest electricity in the portfolios any place in the country. So if we supported, for example, Northwestern Energy to step out and build new generation, it would by definition increase the cost of electricity in Montana. We do have the highest cost of electricity in our region, higher than the other states that surround us. Those that had the foresight not to jump over the cliff with utility deregulation. This is one of the poorest pieces of public policy in the history of Montana. How do we re-regulate? Well, in order to re-regulate, we would have to somehow get those old generation sources that are now owned by Pennsylvania Power and Light back into the portfolio. But I am not advocating that we condemn those dams, that we condemn those coal-fired plants. This was a private transaction. That legislature in 1997, they set this in motion. It doesn't make Pennsylvania Power and Light a bad company or Northwestern a bad company. If you want to find out who caused this, all you've got to do is talk to those legislators in 1997 and the governor in 1997 and ask them, why did you do that? Now, here's where we're at. Pennsylvania Power and Light now owns those assets. Who among us would go to Pennsylvania Power and Light and say, get out of the way, we are taking your assets? We tried to vote as a referendum to buy back the dams from Pennsylvania Power and Light. I think that referendum lost 2-1, and some have suggested putting that back on the ballot. I'll bet you that Pennsylvania Power and Light, who've made millions of dollars in the last few years owning those assets, would spend not $3 million this time, $5 million, $8 million, $10 million, $20 million, whatever it takes to win at the ballot box. So here's what we can do. We can have a strong entity like Northwestern that has market power to step out and forward contract electricity for a long period of time so that we get the best market rates. In lieu of having energy production, the best next thing is to have a company that is strong enough so that they can write long-term contracts. Unfortunately, Northwestern is a company that has about as many assets as it does liabilities. And so if you're one of the generators of electricity, are you sure you want to sign a 10-year contract with a company that might be broke or gone in 2 years?
Isn't the management of Northwestern Energy more interested in selling itself than acquiring long-term contracts for energy?
Well, it would appear, based on some of their actions, that that might be accurate. But when the cities proposed to buy them, they have rebuffed them. Mm-hmm. And when the cities proposed that they had raised the funds or could raise the funds, Northwestern said, no, we intend to be here for the long haul. But they haven't been contracting long-term in their portfolio. And some even argue that they're not investing in the transmission and distribution system at a rate that would make you believe that they're going to be in business. I am not going to assign motives to them.
Well, they've allowed, five or six entities to look at their books for due diligence. So they're not doing that for reasons to pass the
sure.
time. They're looking to sell it.
It is a publicly traded company, so they are for sale. You could buy them all if you wanted to tomorrow, just start bidding up the price.
That's right. But I do want to make a comment that the governor of the state of Montana in 1997, in recent interviews and guest columns to Montana Papers, insists that deregulation was a success.
Well, that is delusional. It has not been a success, as also recent articles have demonstrated, I believe, in the Lee newspapers by Mr. Dennison, who had studied utility deregulation and was there in the 1997 session and reported about the follies of their way while they were doing it. Mike Dennison has actually looked at the states that surround us. None of them brought utility deregulation. We had cheaper electricity than they did before utility deregulation, and now our prices are higher than each and every one of them.
I understand his email after that was 95% in his favor, Mr. Dennison.
Well, I can't address that, but I think the former governor, who hasn't spent enough time in Montana, probably hasn't recognized the consequences of the energy prices going up. And in particular, he may not have known anybody that was a shareholder in Montana Power, because there were thousands, 10, I think 12, 13,000 people that lost their savings, and some of them their life savings, because of utility deregulation. Any public policy person who doesn't step up and take responsibility and say, you know what, I don't get everything right, and I got this one wrong. I can tell you that when I get things wrong, I'll tell you, I've had some things wrong.
We got that on tape
in the future. What's that?
We got that on tape.
Oh, yeah, and when I'm wrong, I'll admit it. They had it wrong in 1997, and most of the public policy makers in Montana will now admit it. Some that have left apparently haven't been paying attention.
Let's go now to a caller in Bozeman. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, your
Hello,
question
governor.
For the governor.
Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I am really encouraged by your support for alternative energy, and I loved your answer to the caller who asked about what we can do as consumers about energy conservation and efficiency. And I think since you have sort of the national bully pulpit right now, it would be really great to hear you encourage that, you know, nationally, that if we're really going to take hold of global warming and energy sustainability and independence, we really need to cut our rate of consumption. So that's kind of a note of encouragement. And then I have a question about coal. I just wonder if how realistic it is or how honest it is really to talk about clean coal, and if that's really talking about some future technology that doesn't really exist right now.
Well, what you need to do is look in your rearview mirror, because in Beulah, North Dakota, they have a coal gasification plant that has run since 1984. They are removing 100% of the mercury and sulfur, and the carbon dioxide is right now, and has been for the last number of years, pumped into oil fields and sequestered. It's called enhanced oil recovery. This is not future technology. You don't even have to go very far. Little town of Beulah, North Dakota, has been doing it since 1984.
Let's go now to a caller in Billings.
Yes, Governor.
How you doing?
Okay. I really appreciated your very lucid description of the problems that coal bed methane wastewater can cause for irrigators and for the land if it's applied to the land. And you mentioned three solutions, two of which are available right now, the reinjection or the treatment to remove the sodium. And on March 23rd, the Board of Environmental Review will be considering writing rules on how to handle this coal bed methane water. And I was wondering, before them is the question of requiring reinjection or treatment. And I was wondering if you would or have you already written a letter to the board asking them to support these two solutions in their rulemaking to protect Montana's irrigators.
Very good question, and the answer to that question is no, and I'll tell you why. I'm using good science in these determinations. There are places when you drill to the coal seam that you don't have high sodium water, and if the SARs are like 5, 6, 7, something like that, then there's nothing wrong with the quality of that water, and that water could be put right into an irrigation canal, and it is not going to be detrimental in irrigating. But if it's 40 or 50, then it has to be managed in a different way. If you were to blanketly say you must re-inject, even if you're in a situation where the aquifer is naturally recharging and you don't have high sodium water, then you're not using good science. When I say to these coal bed methane operators, we want to regulate you with good science, then we have to use good science on both sides. We can't just with emotion say, under all circumstances you will re-inject, or under all circumstances you must treat, or under all circumstances you must evaporate it. So what I am advocating is that it has to be best management practices based on that specific location. If we were to say that all must be re-injected, even though in the case where you have an aquifer that's recharging, so it's not putting the farmer and rancher at risk of losing the water for their cattle or sheep, and in cases where you have low sodium water, then I would be trying to say it both ways. We're suggesting that we need to use good science in management of coal bed methane. And for you listeners, as Jackie and Jim know, I've been drinking tea. I've somewhat lost my voice. Some of you have been, I don't know, I hope it's not the avian flu. I don't think it's made it to Montana yet.
We have to call
yet,
a vet for you.
I don't know if the first consequence of that is that you lose your voice, but it could be. You know, I was back in Washington, D.C., at the National Governors Association. Turns out it's a town full of talkers, and if you need to keep up, you know, you got to do some talking, and I think they just wore me out.
Before we jump into our next call, I want to ask you about a presentation from two of the professors from the University of Montana. Their talk was somewhat provocative during the annual Bureau of Business and Economic Research tour. And I just say as a caveat, they said this is not something that they came up with. Basically, they sent out a questionnaire to Montana businesses. Montana businesses responded and said, these are our concerns, including workers' compensation rates. But what was so provocative had to do with right to work and then at-will employment.
And healthful environment.
And clean and healthful environment. I mean, among just some of the...
Let me jump right to this.
And you know, what comes up, Governor, is academic freedom.
Fine. They can have all the academic freedom they want. But when they started these propositions and they had meetings across Montana, they called it a survey and they called it a poll. But when we pushed them on it, they said, well, it wasn't actually a poll. It wasn't a scientific survey. It was more of, we got emails from some business people across Montana. But they tried to pass it off as a survey or a poll. If you're going to present something as scientific evidence, well, there are some parameters that we'd expect from you. And by the way, this same bunch, 15 years ago, when Montana's economy was one of the poorest economies in America, when our wages were the lowest, we had been declining, they had the same recommendations as they did today, when Montana has one of the fastest growing economies in America, one of the fastest growing periods in the history of Montana. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, they said, well, based on all of this economic data, we're proposing the following three things. Well, guess what? Now we have one of the best economies in America, and they propose the same medicine for a healthy patient as they did a sick patient. This
but
is
in,
a tired
in a way, isn't
old
it,
record.
I mean, are you shooting the messenger, which just happened to be two faculty members from the University of Montana? Or is it the businesses that supposedly reported in and said that these are their concerns?
It was not a poll. It was not a survey. You know, if I want to go out to Montana and get what I want, for example, go back to the quarters. If I've already decided which quarter I want, well, by golly, I'll set it up the way I want to, and I'll go out and talk to a few of my pals, and I'll say, what do you think of this proposition of this quarter? You like it? And if they say no, well, I won't write that one down. I'll go talk to somebody until I get the information that I want. If you represent something as a survey, it better dang sure be a survey. I am a scientist, and I take umbrage to a university professor claiming that they have a poll or a survey, when in fact it was non-scientific and it was just some information they received from some businesses.
But you didn't do yourself any favors by sounding like a former governor of Alabama. Because it was George Corley Wallace that brought up those pointy-head intellectuals that he was putting down up there at Harvard.
No, what I said is that these professors ought to go out and actually talk to the businesses that are starting in Montana, talk to the successful businesses in Montana, and I also called them on the carpet because they're making the same tired recommendations that they made 5, 10, and 15 years ago when we did have a bad economy. But now when we have one of the fastest-growing economies in America and they're proposing the same medicine for a healthy patient as they did a sick one, And then they tried to pass off their work as a survey or a poll, and when they were challenged on it, they backed down. I respect good science. I respect people who do their research. I don't respect people who say, this is the end result, and now I am going to put the pieces together to get me there.
There's still a certain segment of Montana business community, though, that insists that all of those three issues is what's keeping them from making their healthy business. So the arguments are still, they're still debatable, and to bring those points up is still valid for points of debate. And you did call them pointy-head intellectuals, right?
Professors.
Professors. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I'm very happy. I'm a scientist myself. I'm a published researcher, and I understand what that means. And I respect the work that you do at universities. But tell you what, if we're going to have intellectual freedom, does that not mean that if we're going to have a debate about this, that we can disagree?
I'm currently taking a course on this campus in which the professor suggested that any member of the class can attack an idea, but they can't attack the person. And if they do attack the idea, they must present something which they perceive to be a better idea.
What I said is that they need to get out and speak to those businesses that are actually growing in Montana and do not try and present their work as a poll or a survey when, in fact, it was just some information they obtained from some friends. And that's a fact.
Let's go now to a caller in Bozeman.
Hello?
Hello? Yes, your question for Governor Schweitzer.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking these questions. I have actually three questions. One, is there a wind energy component for your energy plan? The second is, have you studied the possibility of hydrogen generation through the process of electrolysis from the water that's coming out of the coal bed methane extraction process that might prove to be, you know, better for the electrolysis because of the increased sodium? And then the third one, are there any tax breaks either on the books or possibility of being put on the books for passive solar designs in new home construction, since that seems to be kind of a driving force in Western Montana economy?
Great questions all. Let's start with wind energy. In the last legislature, we proposed and passed a renewable energy standard that said that by 2010, 10% of the electricity in our portfolio will be wind power or renewable, but in Montana that probably means wind, and by 2015 it'll be 15%. When I cut the ribbon on that Judith Gap project, Montana went from 50th place in generation of electricity, last place, behind Rhode Island, which isn't even the size of a decent-sized ranch, to number 15 in the country. We are now producing 8.5% of our portfolio. I am meeting with wind operators from around the world. I fully expect hundreds of millions of dollars of more investment, and we will get well beyond the 15% well before 2015. Secondly, on my desk, there are very few things in the governor's office. One of is a statue of Shep to honor that loyal livestock dog, and so Shep has an honored place on my desk. The other thing is on my desk is a hydrogen generator, which consists of a solar panel connected to some electrons. Jackie's looking at me; she's seen it. And these electrons are pumped into some distilled water in some beakers. Those beakers, through electrolysis, separate the hydrogen from the oxygen and store the pure hydrogen. And when high school kids come in to visit with me, I say, I want to show you the picture of the future of energy. And then I walk in with this hydrogen generator, and I flip a switch, and the fan starts to run because I have stored pure energy in the dark as pure hydrogen. So you bet I understand hydrogen electrolysis, and there will be spent heat from this coal gasification project, and you could use electrolysis. And tax breaks for passively designed homes, yes, we have that. In fact, if you retrofit your home, we have tax credits up to $500 per year on that home.
Well, with that, Governor, we will say that the hour is over. Want to thank all of our listeners who called in or tried to call in. I apologize if we couldn't get all of your questions, your phone calls tonight. I guess, Governor, that's just a sign that people want to continue to talk to you. So Certainly welcome you back in the future.
It's a great state and a lot of smart people, and I just love to hear from them.
And so with that, I'd like to thank Governor Brian Schweitzer for coming in and submitting to an hour of grilling. Also, thank you to my colleague and co-host, Jim Gransberry of the Billings Gazette. And thank you, Jim.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in the studio. And also thank you to Ken Siebert and Guy Moody for their technical assistance this evening. I'm Jackie Yamanaka, and good night.